Okay, so I am preaching in Philippians, and a little background information about the letter to the Philippians. Paul wrote this letter while he was in prison in Rome, and the reason why Paul was in prison during this time is actually explained in the book of Acts. From chapter 21 to the end of the book, chapter 28, it describes this whole ordeal of why Paul is in Rome. And what Paul is in jail in Rome. And the reason is that in one of his missionary journeys, Paul ends up going to Jerusalem. He goes to visit the temple in Jerusalem. And during this time, some of the Jews recognize him as the missionary preaching about Jesus Christ. And these Jews, as enemies of Jesus Christ, as enemies of the gospel, they lay hold of him. They want to kill him. They call him a blasphemer. They think he's corrupting the Jewish faith. So they're starting this riot. They're getting all these people together in hopes that they would, you know, stone him to death. But what happens was the Roman forces in the town intervene, and they arrest Paul for his own protection because they see that they're trying to kill him. The Jews are trying to kill him. So they arrest him. And at the initial trial for Paul, the Jews were bringing accusations against Paul that he was a menace to society, that he is bringing chaos and disorder, that he's trying to undermine the Roman rule. But Paul is defending himself, saying that he was doing nothing wrong, that he was only preaching the gospel of God. So ultimately what happens is that Paul is taken to Rome to stand before the emperor himself for his trial, which is his right as a Roman citizen. And it's while he's in prison in Rome that he writes this letter, and it's while he's in prison that the book of Acts finishes. He's in prison, he's preaching the gospel to whoever will listen, and he is waiting for his trial before the emperor. So the Philippians hear about what happened to Paul. They hear that he is in prison, and the Philippians, out of concern, out of love, having, you know, heard his gospel, having received Jesus Christ through his preaching, they want to support him, help him out. And what they do is they send some money to him that they gathered, and Paul is writing this letter to thank them, to encourage them also in their faith, that they will continue living the life of faith even though he's suffering this persecution and even though he's in jail. Now, if I can kind of summarize this passage, I think what Paul is really getting to the heart of what the Christian life is, that he's saying that he has this great confidence in their lives because of how it's being expressed in their labor, in their love, in their perseverance of their faith. That he is sure of their salvation because God has started this work in them, and he is confident that God is going to finish it. And the proof, the evidence of God's work in their lives is their labor, their love, and their perseverance. And I feel that what we have to learn today as a church is to be reminded in this way that the assurance of our salvation, the assurance that God really is at work in our lives, is if our faith is being expressed through labor and love and perseverance. Now, Paul begins this letter by thanking God, and Paul knows that if God hadn't revealed himself, if God wasn't the one who was doing this in their lives, transforming them, changing them, that the Philippians would not have been a partner with him in the work of the gospel. That if God himself was not initiating, transforming, and at work in their lives, that the Philippians wouldn't care about Paul, wouldn't care about his ministry. So I think the first assurance of salvation that Paul is hinting at is this labor, is this partnership that the Philippians are, the way that they're expressing their faith. Now in verse 4 and verse 7, Paul calls them verse 5, Paul describes their labor as a partnership in verse 4 and as partakers in verse 7. For you are all partakers with me of grace. And the Greek root word for partnership and partakers, the Greek root word is koinonia. Koinonia. And we often understand this word as fellowship. We kind of understand it or describe it as fellowship. But I kind of find it interesting that when people say fellowship now in the church, we just kind of think, hanging out, getting to know each other, or maybe even, you might have some affection for the people around you. This idea of a fellowship that we have is just, people getting together. But Paul is making it a point, and this is actually a theme throughout the letter, that real koinonia, real fellowship, involves labor. It involves sacrificial service. It involves work. And that's why the ESV translators, intentionally use partnership here. While they might translate fellowship, koinonia as fellowship in other passages, they're focusing on the labor aspect by translating a partnership. So that what is implied in Paul's usage of this word is that this relationship of the Christian life, that when you come together in faith, there is an implication of duties and responsibility toward one another and for the work of the gospel, for the sake of the kingdom. Now, Paul states in verse 5 that the Philippians were partners with him in the gospel since the beginning, from the first day until now. And the reason that Paul says this is because ever since Paul first preached the gospel to the Philippians in Acts 16, ever since then they were so convicted that they were continually supporting Paul wherever he went. After Philippi, he went to Corinth. After Corinth, he went to Thessalonica. And each time the Philippians took the time to gather, bunch of money together and to send, someone to help them, send someone to help Paul and to deliver, this financial support, to give Paul a word of encouragement. And they were continually doing this even up to Paul's imprisonment in Rome. Paul's in jail in Rome, and the Philippians are continually their support, continuing their partnership in the gospel for the sake of the spread of the gospel and missions, by, sending Epaphroditus, one of their leaders, and, this sum of money that they had collected, gathered together. And this was interesting during the time because the prison system in the ancient Greco-Roman world was not funded by the state. So that if you were in prison, the responsibility of taking care of you, of feeding, providing you food and clothing fell on your friends and family. So that the responsibility of sustaining a prisoner fell on other people. And Philippians, having been, transformed by the gospel, having experienced God, they continue to see their relationship with Paul to be expressed by, even supporting him in prison. That even though he's, stuck in prison, they know that as fellow brothers and sisters in the faith, that they have a duty, a responsibility to continue to sacrifice, to give and sacrifice. And it's because of this, and it was because of this labor, because they saw this labor as a joy and duty to be Christians and partner in the work of missions, that Paul has such this deep conviction about their work, about the work of God in their lives. See, as verse 7 says, "It is right for me to feel this way about you all, because I hold you in my heart, for you are all partakers with me of grace, both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel." And this grace that Paul is talking about, "for you all partakers with me of grace," this grace is Paul's calling by Jesus Christ to spread the gospel. And the Philippians, by by supporting Paul financially, by supporting Paul in prayer, by supporting Paul and sending, you know, brothers to help him out in the ministry. They are partakers. They're koinonia. They're in fellowship with Paul. And because of this, Paul is, again, confident that this is God's work in them. This is a sign of assurance of their salvation because of their faithful labor and fellowship in Paul's ministry. And Paul is stressing that this is only possible by the grace of God. This is only possible because God is at work in their lives. Now, I think the labor aspect of the Christian faith is a challenge for the church today. You see, the commitment that the Philippians showed was that they made the church and its mission the center of their lives, and in doing so, they made God the center of their lives, because this is the will of God. They were expressing the will and the work of God in their lives. But this is in complete opposition to the temptation of the world, you know, which wants you to make your own pleasure, your own security, the first priority of your life. But real fellowship, real koinonia in the church demands self-sacrifice and commitment for the sake of the gospel. So the Philippians didn't give only when it was convenient. The Philippians didn't give only, you know, when they had extra spare change. But they give to their utmost. They gave to as much as they were able. And Paul describes this in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Paul is writing to the Corinthians and he's saying, "We want you to know, Corinthians, about the grace of God that has been given among the churches of Macedonia." And Philippi was part of Macedonia. "For in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty has overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For they gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means, of their own accord, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints." And Paul is describing the grace of God at work in the Philippians as this expression of labor. They want to give. They want to give. They want to be a part of the mission of spreading the gospel. They want to be part of the mission of building up the church. And because of this, Paul is assured of the Philippians' salvation. He has such confidence in the Philippians' salvation. This is how Paul is assured. They truly believe that Jesus Christ died for their sins. They truly believe and have put their trust in Jesus Christ as their Lord and labor, as their Lord and Savior. And the expression of this is their labor. And his whole letter is just filled with Paul's joyful passion, excitement, and encouragement, because he is so in awe. He is so full of thanks and worship of God, because only God can do this. Only God can transform, you know, selfish, sinful people to give for the sake of something that they can't see with their eyes, the kingdom of God. To be a part of something that they yet do not see the full expression of, the gospel at work in the world. And so Paul knows that God is truly at work in their lives. Now again, I said, I think this labor aspect of the Christian faith is a challenge to the church, because of the temptation of the world. And I think one way that we can fight the temptation, the pressure that the world puts on us, is by considering our jobs, you know, the jobs that we have earning a living, as not as a center of our lives, but as a means that God has given us to provide, that we may also provide and labor and be a part of the work of the kingdom, of the spreading of the gospel, of building up the church. And I think Paul also kind of has this in mind when in Ephesians, when Paul writes, "Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. So that, you know, the reason that we have jobs, the reason that we work in the world is what God has given us as a means to do his work. I mean, we're not all called to be pastors or we're not all called to be missionaries, but God has given us jobs or financial means that's in excess so that we can be part of God's work, that we can partner with missionaries and churches and pastors and be involved in the work of God. And that this should be the center. This should be, you know, the focus of our lives. This is what we also, like Paul, you know, delight, rejoice to see. But again, we see the contrary of this in the world. I mean, we see this in the economic recession. We see this in the housing bubble. We see business people, you know, selling bad financial investments because they don't care about the consequences. They don't care about the ethical problems. All they care is about, you know, the bottom line. All they care about is making money. And I have this church. I mean, I have this friend who I grew up in church, and he works in Manhattan. And he's so angry and frustrated because he's not getting as much money as he should. You know, he's not getting as much money as he deserves. And because of this, you know, financial recession, you know, he hasn't got any raises for the past 3 years. And every time I talk to him, it really comes down to this frustration that he has. He always brings it up. But he also calls himself a Christian. He calls himself a Christian, but all he can think about, all his agony, all his anger, is expressed in that he feels entitled to the money that he feels entitled to his salary, but he's not getting what he thinks he deserves. But the attitude that Paul is encouraging, that the attitude that Paul is trying to teach and instill in the Philippians, is that their lives should be centered around generosity for the sake of God's gospel, for his gospel, and for the sake of God's people. Now, I was talking about jobs, in the future when you're working, but I think now as college students, one way we can kind of cultivate this thinking right now, this thinking of mentality, this thinking that God's church and God's kingdom, God's gospel should be the center of our lives. I think one way we can cultivate this thinking that fellowship is more than just hanging out, but it's labor and work and sacrifice, is through offering in the church. Because, you know, oftentimes when the offering basket comes around, we're just thinking, oh shoot. You know, we feel compelled. We're caught off guard. We're unprepared. But I think by taking the time to prepare for our offering for Sunday service, you know, either come early, come before praise starts, think about it. Prepare your hearts. Or even the night before on Saturday, think about your offering. Recognize that it is part of worship. It's the emphasis that the presider, Eugene, was, you know, mentioned. Let us continue our worship by offering our tithes. And by recognizing this, that giving to God is an expression of our faith, that we are cultivating this mindset, that our joy should be laboring, our joy should be in fulfilling our duties as Christians and doing the work of God, to be a part of the work that God is doing in the world. You're recognizing that everything you receive is from God. It's not because of your abilities or your worth, but is recognizing that God gives life to all people. God is gracious to all people, even to sinful and wicked people. So as we acknowledge that God has given freely, as we prepare our offerings, we should struggle and ask God for faith that we in turn may give freely, that our joy and our delight would be in the work of his kingdom, and that we want to be a part of it. So I kind of think as college students, you know, that we should begin kind of with offering and then let it expand into other areas of your life. If ever a need comes, every once in a while, KC has a collection for missionaries or short-termers. No, we should continually struggle and to ask God for grace, that we may give generously, that we may be faithfully laboring in the work of the gospel and his kingdom. So I'm basically saying, you know, give more money to the church. Give more money to the church and give more money to missions. And I can say this with a clean conscience because I'm not getting paid at KCC. I'm not getting any money. So if you give more money to KCC, I'm not going to see any of it. Pastor John didn't tell me to say, you know, we need more money in the church. Pastor John did not say that. I feel like it's important. This is how we cultivate this sort of thinking that Paul is teaching in Philippians. It's an important part, and it's an assurance of our salvation. It's assurance that God really is at work in our lives, that we really know the power and abundance and the grace and the mercy, the love of God. How we think about money is a necessary part of our faith. But at the same time, I want to warn you, because there are a lot of churches that say, the more you give to the church, the more God will bless you. I want to say, be careful of this, because this is not true. God does not promise a proportional earthly blessing or an earthly reward. God does not promise these things. But rather, we give because it is God's will. We give because it's expression of God's trust. And we give because we're fighting the temptation that Paul writes of in 1 Timothy, that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And by struggling with trying to be generous to others, we can fight this temptation and be assured of our salvation. A second source of assurance that I think Paul is demonstrating in this passage is love. And he shows it by this expressive and joyful way that Paul writes. You know, Paul first has this deep love for God, that he desires God alone to be glorified in all of creation. This is why Paul thanks God for his work among the Philippians. Paul is rejoicing in God's grace and power because it's being manifested in this transformed living that the Philippians are living out. See, when Paul sees God doing the impossible, transforming sinful people into a godly people who desire and pursue after God's kingdom, Paul gets excited. He's rejoicing. When Paul sees God transforming selfish people to give generously, to serve one another, Paul is rejoicing, giving thanks to God. And that's true love for God. That is the love for God. Paul is rejoicing because God's glory is being manifested as he does the impossible, saving sinners. And this is true assurance of salvation when you have this sort of love for God. As Paul writes in Romans 8, for the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, for it does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. Those who are in the flesh cannot please God. This is real love for God when you're in jail and you're facing possible execution over false charges like Paul, but you're still so excited and passionate that the glory and grace of God is at work in the lives of his people. Paul is facing death, and all he's thinking about is rejoicing in how good God is. And in Philippians, Paul twice writes, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Paul's in jail. He doesn't know if he's going to live or die, but he's so filled with joy and love for God because God's glory is being revealed in his people that he keeps on saying, rejoice in the Lord always. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. And that's the love for God that is only possible by the grace of God at work in you. This is an assurance of salvation. Now, a second way that Paul's love is being expressed is towards the Philippians themselves. Paul has his deep love for God, and he has his deep love for the Philippians. And the way he expresses this desire is in Paul's prayer in verse 9, that he desires their love to grow more and more. Paul's love is shown by his desire for the Philippians' love to abound more than more. And their love for who? Their love for God, and their love for Paul himself. See, Paul's love for the Philippians is shown in his desire for them to grow in faith and love for God, and in love and labor towards God's people. And that's why Paul is writing this letter. He wants to encourage them. He wants to spur them on even more. Paul's saying, thank you for how you've been with me for the sake of the gospel, how you've supported me. But more and more, do more for the glory of God. Do more in supporting me. Do more for one another. And this is how Paul expresses his love, that he wants to spur them on. He wants to build up the Philippians' faith more and more. So Paul writes later in chapter 21, verse 23, Paul writes, my desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better, but to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith. Now, Paul felt this serious tension between his desire to die and to be with Christ and his desire to stay for the edification of the Philippians. And what he decides is that staying is better. Staying is the better choice, because to build up your fellow brothers and sisters, to love others, is the better choice. Now, Paul really didn't know what was going to happen. He didn't have control over his faith. Paul wasn't sure if God was going to let him live. But Paul is convinced, and he strives, that building up the Philippians' faith should be the focus of his life, whether he lives or dies. This is how Paul expresses his love for the Philippians. He wants to build up their faith, and this love is an assurance of salvation. Now, when you think about Paul, you know, facing execution, he's in jail, and yet he's filled with love for God and for God's people, and you think, you know, that's Paul, he's a super apostle. But what Paul is actually telling the Philippians is that they should have the same kind of love that he has for them. Let me rephrase that. That the love that Paul has for the Philippians, he is encouraging the Philippians to have that same love for one another and for him, for Paul. I hope that's clear. I hope I'm not being unclear. But he's saying, he's giving himself as a model. He's saying, love like as the way I am loving. And we see this because in verses 7 and 8, he's talking about his love for them. In verses 7 and 8, Paul is talking about how much he loves the Philippians. It is right for me to feel about this way because I have you in my heart. And in verse 8, I yearn for you all with the affection of Christ Jesus. He's talking about how much he loves them. But in verse 9, he says, it is my prayer that your love may abound more and more. You see what Paul did there? Isn't that so slick? I mean, he's saying, I love you so much. I love you so much. But I pray that your love may grow more and more. And the implication is, love the way I love. Love God the way I love God. Love each other as the way I love you. Paul is making himself, you know, an example, a model of faith. And that this is an assurance of salvation. This is an expression of God's work in people's lives. Now, thankfully, you know, we don't have to choose between dying and being with Christ and loving our brothers and sisters. You know, thankfully, persecution isn't like that here in America. But it's a mentality that Paul is encouraging for the Philippians and for all Christians, for us today. Paul is again trying to change our thinking that always, always, always we should strive, we should struggle with trying to build up our fellow brothers and sisters in the faith. That's love. This love is specific to the purpose of building up another person's faith and love for God and love for others. And this is, you know, deeply tied with labor. If you love someone, you're going to labor for their sake. You're going to sacrifice for their sake, because your joy is the joy of seeing God's work in their lives. Your joy is seeing God's work in their lives, transforming them. So that, you know, when we come together in Koinonia, we should have this intention. You know, we should be intentional to try to say or do something to build up another person's faith. Now, I'm not saying that every time we meet together, we have to be super spiritual. You know, every time we meet together, you know, we don't have to say, you know, hallelujah and something. But it should be our intention, our desire. When we come together, you know, it's not just because we enjoy each other's company, but we have this intention to build each other up in faith. And now, see, and this is something I have to work on. This is something I have to work on because I like to have fun at other people's expense. I like to, you know, I am happy, I am pleased when other people are frustrated. And it's most particular with Eugene. He's the guy who's leading praise. I spend a lot of time with him, and the most fun I have is when Eugene is so frustrated, he starts saying certain phrases. One of them, he goes, "No, no, Steve." Or another one is, that doesn't make any sense. But my personal favorite is when he's so frustrated, he has no words, so he does this. He, you know, he's looking around saying, and the expression says it all. He's saying, did you hear what he said? Did you hear what he said? And yeah, so I'm not looking at Eugene, you know, while I'm saying this, because it's more fun to say things when Eugene's not here. But, and well, yeah, the whole point of me saying this is that it's wrong. This is the complete opposite of what Paul is saying here. But as Christians, you know, we have to cultivate this mentality, not have fun at other people's expense, but let us seek to, you know, edify, say something, share with one another what God has been teaching us, share with one another of any blessings that you may have received, and physically, practically serving one another out of joy, because you want to see this person grow in faith. That is love, and that is an assurance of salvation. That is an assurance that God is truly at work in our lives, transforming sinful, selfish people like me, and to say, "Eugene, I'm so encouraged by you. I gotta work on it." So we have two sources of salvation that Paul is mentioning in this passage: sacrificial labor for the sake of the gospel and the kingdom, and this love that is intentional, a way of thinking and being, a way of living, that in all aspects, in any and every way you want to build up your fellow brothers and sisters in the faith, that's your joy, that is your desire. And the third source of salvation I think Paul hints at in this passage is perseverance. Excuse me. Now, when Paul first preached the gospel to the Philippians in Acts 16, Paul got arrested because of this, you know, strange incident. There was a demon-possessed girl, and then Paul cast out the demon, but then people were upset because this demon could tell the future, was a fortune teller, and people were making money from this fortune telling. So they persecuted Paul. They beat him without a fair trial, and they put him in jail without a fair trial. And this, you know, and even the fact that though he was a Roman citizen, it was unlawful. But even witnessing this persecution, the Philippians still wanted to continue in the faith. They still accepted Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. And even after Paul left, they themselves were experiencing persecution from their former friends, their former neighbors, their former business partners and clients, that they were being rejected. Even still, they were persevering in the faith. They're persevering and laboring to be a partner with Paul in the gospel. persevering and trying to love each other more. Now, I think it's kind of interesting what perseverance looks like in the church today, because when persecution came in the ancient world, it was clear. I mean, if you didn't worship the emperor as a god, I mean, you would be arrested. If you didn't sacrifice and worship the patron god of your guild, like everybody had clubs. There was a clothing club, blacksmith club, merchant club. Everyone had a club. Every club had a god. And if you were not worshiping at this god, to this god, you were kicked out of this club. If you were kicked out of the club, you couldn't work. So when persecution came, it was clear, it was sudden, and it was painful. You know, you lost your place in society, you lost your business, your clients, and some people even lost their lives. But today, you know, calling yourself a Christian is not necessarily a big deal. You know, if you just call yourself a Christian, nobody really cares, nobody really makes a fuss. But if you want to take your faith seriously, that's when the problem starts. That's when the social pressure and the Americanized persecution comes about. And I see the result. I see the result of this social pressure. I see the result of this persecution on Facebook. See, on Facebook, it's easy to label yourself as a Christian. It's no big deal. You're just religious views, Christian. Or, you know, people write Jesus Christ, or, you know, some people are more hip. You know, they say Jesus all the way, or, you know, Jesus is my homeboy, or, you know, or some people are trying to be religious, say like Christ lives in me. And it's like, it's so interesting how you can proclaim and make public your faith and not live out the gospel. It's so easy to call yourself a Christian but not obey the gospel. And that's because the temptation, the pressure of the world, the persecution, the subtle persecution of the world is pushing you to live a certain way, so that instead of laboring in fellowship, koinonia, instead of loving intentionally to build up your brothers and sisters, instead of striving to be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, as Paul writes in verse 10, people seek their own pleasure. They satisfy their own sinful desires while calling themselves Christians. You know, they think it's enough to call themselves Christians or to go to church. But Paul's letter doesn't say, okay, you've done enough. You know, you've shown your love. You've suffered. You've given so much money to the work of the kingdom. You've done enough. But Paul instead is trying to spur them on. He's saying, grow more in love, in knowledge and discernment. Continually choose what is excellent. Continually be filled with the fruit of righteousness. And this is perseverance. This is the continuing work of God in your life. This is the assurance of salvation. That you are, when you continue, when you persevere, when you are persevering, you can be confident that God is at work in your life. So that Paul can say, I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Christ. So throughout this letter, Paul is just filled with joy over the Philippians. He is so assured and confident of their salvation, because he is so sure and confident of the God who has started this work will finish it. Paul is overflowing with thanks and praise and worship, because he is so in awe of God who is so powerfully at work in their lives. And this is only by the grace of God. This is only by the grace of God. And for a man like Paul, there is no greater joy than witnessing a holy people who acknowledge and recognize God as the one true God. That is, for a Christian, that should be our greatest joy, that the world recognizes and acknowledges, worships, delights in, desires God as the one true God. This is an assurance of salvation. So as Christians today, as people of God, we should be continually examining ourselves. We should be continually examining ourselves. Am I being faithful in laboring? Am I being faithful in loving? Am I being faithful in persevering? Am I not compromising with the world? Have I really made God and His mission, His work, the center of our lives, center of my life? Yeah. So, I just want to encourage you with this message today. Let's pray. And again, let's just take this time to meditate and to examine our own hearts. We have to be challenged by Paul, his life, challenged by the Philippians, how they suffered for the sake of the kingdom, how they gave for the sake of the kingdom, how they were filled constantly with such joy, such love for God, in God, for God's people, and in God's people, how they persevered, strived to the point of shedding blood to persevere and not compromise with the world. And this is our assurance of salvation, that we don't take the grace of God cheaply, that we don't make it official on Facebook, but there is no assurance and confidence of it even in our lives. So let's just take this time to pray.